After producing the egg, human females must gestate it for 9 months, with every gram of nutrition given to the fetus pipelined from the mother. After giving birth, our female ancestors typically breastfed their babies for another 2 years, with almost every calorie received by the baby being sourced from the mother. This might not seem like a big deal in a world in which the next meal is only as far away as the pantry. Indeed, my wife delighted in the fact that our infant son was a human liposuction machine. But our ancestors found the caloric demand of creating and raising a baby extremely burdensome. Remember, they had to hunt down and kill, or dig up and drag home, every piece of food they ate. As a result of this biologically mandated difference in parental investment, for every unit of energy that a human male must donate to produce a child, human females must donate much more than a million times as many. I haven't actually done the math to compare the metabolic energy required to produce one dose of sperm versus 9 months of gestation and 2 years of lactation. I'm just choosing a large number. I suspect the truth is more one-sided than a million to one by several orders of magnitude. This is where the joint retirement account analogy comes into play. Women have more skin in the game, with the result that men tend to compete for women, and women tend to be much choosier than men. One important way that men compete for women is by showing that they will provide food, shelter, and protection for them and their offspring. Given the caloric cost of having a child, this is a major concern for women, and men have evolved to respond to this concern by showing evidence that they are good providers. Our ancestors displayed their ability to provide by being good hunters, and modern men show their ability to provide by going to college, getting good jobs, or displaying wealth. As I discuss in Chapter 10, because humans form long-term, exclusive bonds in which they work together to raise their children, human mate choice is also a mutual decision. For this reason, in addition to these sex differences, there is a fair bit of competition among both men and women to get the most desirable mate. Sexual selection. Reproduction is the currency of evolution. If every animal had the same number of surviving offspring, there would be no evolution. Survival is important, but only in terms of living long enough to reproduce and pass your genes on to the next generation. Organisms that successfully raise lots of offspring and that facilitate the reproduction of their close relatives pass along their proclivities into the next generation. Organisms that fail to do these things represent the end of the line for their genes, and their particular proclivities disappear from the gene pool. In this manner, traits and behaviors that are associated with reproductive success become more common than traits and behaviors that are not. Due to this process of selection, we evolved to enjoy activities that enhance our reproductive success and dislike activities that don't. For example, almost all adult humans enjoy sex, and almost all humans find feces distasteful. It's no surprise that having sex increases our chance of passing our genes on to the next generation, and also no surprise that eating feces decreases those chances. It's important to note, however, that having sex and eating feces are not really parallel activities with regard to our reproductive success. Having sex has little bearing on survival, but directly relates to creating offspring. In contrast, eating feces diminishes our odds of survival, and thereby diminishes our chance of reproduction. Eating feces probably also diminishes our chance of getting a date. This distinction between factors that directly impact survival and factors that directly impact reproduction was crucial for Charles Darwin, the father of evolutionary theory. If I live 1,000 years but don't reproduce, my incredible longevity is evolutionarily irrelevant. But if I live long enough to see my children through to adulthood, my survival facilitated my reproductive success. Of more direct impact is whether I can attract a mate and successfully reproduce, and hence the capacity to attract and retain a mate is of central importance in evolutionary theory. Darwin used the term sexual selection to describe the evolution of those processes that enhance our access to members of the opposite sex. Sexual selection is a powerful force in evolution. If there is a trait that members of the opposite sex find distasteful, That trait will tend to disappear in the population, even if it facilitates survival, because owners of that trait will have trouble finding mates. For example, it's conceivable that being a super timid guy and hiding at the first sign of danger might have facilitated survival, but most women would have found this an undesirable trait because such a partner probably wouldn't protect her and her children. As a consequence, there haven't been too many super timid guys, or at least not many who were willing to act in a super timid way when women were around. Similarly, if there is a trait that members of the opposite sex find attractive, even if that trait diminishes our chances of survival, it can become common in the population because owners of that trait will have more mating opportunities. This observation leads us to ask why members of the opposite sex would ever find survival diminishing traits attractive. By way of answering this question, consider the difference between males and females of one of the most remarkable birds on the planet, peacocks and peahens. A peahen is a sensible bird, with mostly gray-brown feathers and a tail that is just a little longer than it needs to be. If you were a hungry tiger, you could walk right by a nesting peahen and never know it was there, as it would blend into its surroundings. In contrast, a peacock is an audaciously bright bird that sports the most outrageous tail in the animal kingdom. The peacock's bright coloration would attract the attention of even a myopic tiger, and its cumbersome and heavy tail would make it much easier to catch once spotted. Indeed, the bright and heavy peacock tail seemed like such an impediment to survival that Darwin famously wrote to the Harvard botanist Asa Gray, "The sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick." Darwin is one of history's greatest scientists because he had incredible insight, but also because he worked so hard to address the weaknesses in his theory. In the case of the peacock, he eventually realized that the costs of the bright color and huge tail, in terms of survival, were offset by the gains in reproduction. To understand why the peacock's tail facilitates reproduction, we need to consider why certain traits are attractive. What does it mean to be sexy? Every organism manages the best it can, by whatever means necessary, which ensures that deception is rife among all living things. If deception helps an animal avoid predators or get a mate, then you can count on its being deceptive. My favorite deceptive mating strategies can be found in the species of birds and fish in which some of the males pretend to be females. In these species, males who aren't large enough to fight off other males have evolved a strategy of feigning femininity, which allows them to consort with females without being challenged by bigger males. These small males then seize the opportunity to sneak an occasional copulation, thereby passing on their genes even though they would never win a fight with the larger males who are interested in the same females. Perhaps the most extraordinary example of this strategy was witnessed among cuttlefish by Cullum Brown of Macquarie University and his colleagues. Cuttlefish can change their color at will. And when they aren't disguising themselves to match their background, females often show one color pattern, while males show another. Brown was observing cuttlefish in their tanks one day when he noticed a male displaying male coloration on the half of his body facing the females, and female coloration on the half of his body facing the males. This deception allowed the two-faced male to court the females while simultaneously preventing the other males from attacking him. Such deceptions show how animals can be dishonest to achieve their goals. No surprise here, evolution is amoral, and animals adopt whatever strategy works. But life is a co-evolutionary struggle, with every organism evolving counter-strategies to deal with the strategies of their competitors. In this sense, evolution is an endless arms race, with animals developing new ways of responding whenever they are faced with novel capabilities on the part of their prey, predators, or parasites. If the balance tips too far in favor of one or the other, then extinction becomes a distinct possibility. When prey animals evolve a disguise, predators evolve greater detection abilities. If males evolve ways to deceive females into choosing them when they are a poor choice, females evolve ways of seeing through this ruse, Females who are easily duped by low-quality males are less likely to leave successful offspring in subsequent generations, so female preferences are shaped by evolution to favor males who show honest signals of quality. An honest signal of quality is one that is impossible, or at least very difficult, to fake. For example, I can tell you about my yacht and brag about my ski vacations, but unless you've seen my balance sheets, you don't know whether I'm loaded or a liar. Talk is cheap. But if I fly you to St. Moritz and scoot us around in a Maserati, that's a much better signal that I'm well-heeled and generous, too. I can also casually mention that I graduated first in my class at Harvard Law School. But again, I could be lying to impress you, so you'd be wise to doubt my claim. In contrast, it's more convincing if you watch me easily solve a Rubik's Cube, as that allows you to see my brain in action. It's more impressive still if I can solve a Rubik's Cube without looking back at it once I begin, because I'm demonstrating that I can win with a handicap. Due to the importance of honest signals, humans are very adept at detecting even subtle cues that indicate quality. I remember one spring morning in college when I was sitting in the courtyard waiting for my friends to join me for breakfast. I happened to have a copy of the New York Times and a pen, so I decided to attempt the crossword puzzle while I waited, despite being hopeless at crosswords. As I sat staring at the first clue, pondering, brought to tears, possibly, an older alumnus and his family walked by. He saw me working on the puzzle and sat down to join in. I could have used his help, but before he got a chance, his wife grabbed him by the ascot and pointed out, "He's working on the Sunday puzzle with a pen, dear. He does not need your help." She interpreted my subsequent claims to the contrary as pure politeness, and they walked around the corner to admire the blooming trees. A few minutes passed by, and as luck would have it, my brilliant friend Katrin plopped down next to me as I continued to wonder who was brought to tears and why only possibly. She solved the first few dozen clues as fast as I could write the answers, at which point I realized I was now merely a scribe and shooed her away so I could give it a try. With perfect timing, the alumnus and his family passed by again, and when he tried to sit down for a second time, his wife admonished him. "Dear, he's solved nearly half the puzzle in less than 5 minutes. He does not need your help." Trying to solve a crossword puzzle with a pen is not really an honest signal, but solving it is. In this particular case, it was an honest signal of Katrin's intelligence. And that's why we pay attention to such details. To return to the peacock, its bright color and extraordinary tail are honest signals of male quality because they are an enormous handicap. And that's why the peahen finds the bright colors and huge tail so alluring. Growing a large and brightly colored tail is a bit like trying to solve the Sunday crossword with a pen. Any idiot can start the process, but it takes a pretty special organism to carry it off. Peahens are responsive to this fact, so they are attracted to peacocks who are able to survive year after year, despite schlepping around 5 feet of brightly colored tail feathers. A mature peacock could well be the most honest signaler in the animal kingdom, but lots of birds adopt a toned-down version of this strategy. Numerous species have long tail feathers, and when biologists artificially shorten or lengthen their tails, they find that females respond accordingly, flocking to the long-tailed lads and shunning those who've had their tail feathers clipped. Not only do females of many bird species find long tails sexy, but as we saw with peacocks, color is also important. Bright colors advertise your presence to predators, so female birds can use the brightness of a male's colors to deduce his quality. A brightly colored bird must be strong and fit to survive looking that way, whereas a dull-colored lad may well be slow and clumsy, and thus would be less suitable as a mate. Keep in mind that female birds aren't thinking this through. Rather, those females who prefer brightly colored males leave more offspring in the next generation, and hence pass on the tendency to prefer bright colors. The same holds true for human preferences. We don't need to understand why we find an hourglass shape attractive in women, or a triangular shape attractive in men. Evolution simply ensures that most people have these preferences. So, Birds are evolutionarily primed to prefer bright colors, but not all colors are created equal. Animal immune systems rely on plant pigments called carotenoids, such as beta-carotene, to function properly, but animals are incapable of producing carotenoids on their own. They rely on plant photosynthesis to do the job for them. Animals who are struggling to fight off infections need to dedicate every bit of carotene to their immune systems, whereas healthy animals have an excess of carotenoids in their system. The reds, oranges, and yellows that many birds display on their feathers are made up of carotenoids. Because birds can afford those colors only if their immune system is robust, bright colors, particularly bright reds, oranges, and yellows, are honest signals of internal quality, even though they are being worn on the outside. Bright reds are inherently honest signals of quality due to the metabolic cost in producing them, but there are other honest signals of quality that anyone can produce. For example, some birds have evolved to signal their dominance through the size of a black or brown patch on their chest or throat. Black feathers are no more costly than white feathers to produce, yet in these species, a larger dark patch indicates a higher position in the hierarchy. This was confusing when it was first discovered, as even the weakest males can easily grow a large patch. It might seem odd to suggest that a bird can decide whether to grow a large or small patch, but dominance is associated with hormonal changes which in turn lead to bodily changes. These effects can be seen in numerous species, such as when a cichlid fish develops bright coloration to signal that it now holds a territory. And hence it seemed that female birds of these species were falling for cheap talk. But further study revealed that other males take these color patches very seriously and don't take kindly to subordinates strutting around with large dark patches as if they're dominant. Wearing the wrong size patch is an affront to every other male in the flock. And when biologists tested this possibility by painting larger black patches on low-status males, they essentially painted a target on their chests. Every other male in the flock will go out of its way to attack such usurpers, in an effort to show them that they're just posers and would be wise to shrink their patch. In such cases, the size of a patch becomes an honest signal, even though it can be produced without biological cost, thanks to the social consequences of wearing a larger patch than one should. Growing a larger patch than you've earned is a lot like wearing a Red Sox cap to Stan's sports bar in the Bronx during a Yankees game. Cheap to buy, expensive to wear. What are honest signals of quality in human males? Size is a good indicator, as you can't grow to be 6 feet tall if you're not well-nourished and healthy. Muscles are also a good indicator, as is athleticism, for the same reason. But of course, humans care a great deal about brains as well as brawn, and markers of a good mind are also honest signals of quality. That is why women tend to find a sense of humor sexy. Not only is it fun to be around funny people, but a good sense of humor requires an agile mind to draw connections that other people find funny. Facial symmetry is also an honest indicator of quality, as humans have evolved to be symmetric, but illness and accidents can disrupt that symmetry. Symmetry is a signal of health and genetic robustness, or at the very least a blessed life, and thus women tend to find it attractive. If you Google Brad Pitt and look at his face, you'll be struck by its symmetry. If you Google Lyle Lovett, you'll be struck by the indicators of a difficult life. Symmetry, strength, height, and humor are also honest signals of quality in women, but they are not the primary markers of quality that attract men's attention. Because being fertile is much more biologically demanding for women than it is for men, men are more interested in women's honest signals of fertility. Most notably, men are attracted to signs of youthfulness and an hourglass shape, both signals of female fertility. If humans were like chimps in their reproductive habits, and women became more successful mothers as they aged, then no doubt men would be strongly attracted to older women. The evolution of menopause among human females has changed that equation. More on this issue in Chapter 10. With the result that men are more attracted to women during their most fertile period, from their late teens to mid-30s. Although there is a lot less work on partner preferences and sexual attitudes among members of the LGBTQ community, The research that does exist often paints a similar picture. For example, my colleagues and I found that whether men were straight, bisexual, or gay, they tended to regret missed sexual opportunities more than they regretted bad sex they'd had. In contrast, whether women were straight, bisexual, or lesbians, they tended to regret bad sex they'd had more than missed sexual opportunities. The theory of social relativity. Sexual selection and mate competition are the driving forces behind the power of relativity, that is, the importance of our relative standing compared to others. For example, women evolved to prefer men who are kind, generous, funny, cute, and smart. But even if I'm none of the above, they'll still choose me if I'm their least awful option. It doesn't really matter how smart or attractive I am, so long as I'm smarter and more attractive than the other available men. Similarly, it won't do me a bit of good to look like Henry Cavill and have a brain like Albert Einstein if everyone in my group is better looking and smarter. Although the chances of that are slim, the point is that our absolute levels of any given trait don't matter that much. What matters is how we stack up against the other relevant members of our group. For this reason, people engage in social comparison all the time. We begin this process of social comparison initially to learn about ourselves and our social standing. Am I strong or weak? Fast or slow? Rich or poor? Despite what we might think, there are no absolute answers to these questions. It all depends on how we stack up against other people. If I can bench press more weight than the people who are close to me, I'm strong. If not, I'm weak. Our nearest neighbors are also our most important competition, so we tend to look to those closest to us to answer these questions. The problem with this tendency to look locally is that it can lead to a very skewed worldview. I remember sitting with my friends late in our senior year of high school, reflecting on the highs and lows of the last 4 years. One of my friends said that her biggest regret was her lack of athletic success. She was the state champion in at least 2 sports, competed on the varsity team in several others, and the hardware hanging off her letter jacket would have put a Russian general to shame. I asked her how on earth she could feel that way, given that she was one of the best athletes I knew. She replied that she had failed in her dream to make the Olympic team. That aspiration may sound absurd, but 2 of her siblings had competed in the Olympics, so that was her standard of achievement. We can see the effect of relativity in countless domains, and sometimes it makes perfect sense to worry about everyone else. For example, imagine I invented a pill that increased your intelligence by 50%, and I offered you one. Immediately after taking the pill, you'd feel so much smarter. All sorts of problems that had seemed complex before would now be child's play. Particle physics and calculus problems would be amusing ways to entertain yourself while waiting for a haircut. But now imagine that I offered everyone else 2 pills. You'd be sitting there waiting for your haircut, and everyone around you would be discussing ideas that were way beyond your capacity. In a matter of moments, you'd go from feeling like a genius to feeling like a fool. In this example, it doesn't matter how many pills you take if everyone around you is always 1 pill ahead. Even if you can solve differential equations in your head, if other people are smarter, you'll get the least interesting jobs. Your friends will think you're slow, and more generally, you'll tend to be left behind. Relativity matters in these instances. But because of the importance of sexual selection, we also get caught up in relativity when other people don't really matter. Consider Ilyana Kuchemko of Princeton University and her colleagues' work on last place aversion. They found that the greatest resistance to raising the minimum wage was among people who were making slightly more than that. Despite the fact that raising the minimum wage has a high probability of helping individuals who are making just above minimum wage at some point in the future, their concerns about their relative standing outweighed the potential advantages that might come from a higher minimum wage. Such reactions might seem like cutting off your nose despite your face, but sexual selection provides the underlying logic. Concern with relative standing has also been found in our primate cousins, and is most famously demonstrated in capuchin monkeys by Sarah Brosnan and Franz de Waal of Emory University. In their experiment, they trained monkeys to return a pebble to the experimenter after it was placed in their cage, and the monkeys were paid in cucumber slices for their efforts. The monkeys clearly regarded this payment as fair, given that they learned and sustained the appropriate behavior based on these cucumber rewards. The critical phase of the experiment took place when the monkeys witnessed another monkey receiving a grape, a preferred food, for the same action that they were completing for a cucumber slice. If fairness is an absolute judgment, it shouldn't matter what reward the other monkey receives for doing the same task. If a cucumber slice was good enough a moment ago, it should be good enough now. On the other hand, if fairness is a relative judgment, then it matters a great deal what the other monkey is paid. Consistent with the logic of relativity, the capuchins working for cucumbers often refused to participate further when another monkey was paid in grapes for the same activity. De Waal shows a video from this experiment in his TED Talk, Moral Behavior in Animals, and I highly recommend it, if only to see an irate monkey chuck his cucumber slice at the experimenter after the monkey next door receives a grape. At the risk of anthropomorphizing, I've never seen a fellow primate more outraged at unfair pay than that little capuchin. Experiments such as this one provide compelling evidence that once your survival needs are met, everything else is relative. As we discuss in Chapter 3, life was a zero-sum game in the world before cities. My fortune typically came about only as a result of your misfortune. The sad truth is that the logic of sexual selection ensures that life remains a zero-sum game, even when it doesn't need to be. If my friend gets a big raise or wins the lottery, I am indeed impoverished by his good fortune, because now it'll be harder for me to get a mate. Prior to his achievement or good fortune, the woman I had my eye on might have chosen me. Now there's a good chance she won't, as he's more attractive than he used to be. Sexual selection etches this logic deep into our psyche, making it incredibly difficult for us to rise above it and not feel envy at the success of others, particularly the success of close others. When Sam Smith or Eminem wins a Grammy, I don't get envious because I don't know them, I don't run in their crowd, and I, wisely, don't try to compete with them. The same holds when Leonardo DiCaprio wins an Oscar. His girlfriend wasn't going to go out with me anyway. Yet, it hits close to home when my good friends outperform me, particularly in a domain I value. My favorite demonstration of this effect is a wonderful series of experiments by Abraham Tesser of the University of Georgia and his colleagues. In a typical experiment, Tesser brought male college students into the lab to play a word game. The game was a dictionary-style task in which people passed clues to help their partner guess a target word. Tesser arranged for one participant to go first and rigged the game so that the first player always performed poorly. The key issue concerned the quality of clues that this ostensibly poor-performing participant then went on to give his partner. Some of the clues he could give his partner were designed to be really helpful, and some were designed to be really unhelpful. To make this experiment concrete, imagine you were participating and your task was to help your partner guess the word insightful. If you wanted to help him out, you might give him the clue astute or shrewd. But if you wanted him to fail, you might give him the clue perspicacious. Who knows what that means? Later, if he were to complain, you could point out that if he had a half-decent vocabulary, he'd have nailed it. Tesser found that people were more likely to give helpful clues to their partner if he was a friend rather than a stranger. But this result held only when the task was described as unimportant. When the task was described as an important indicator of verbal skills, Tesser found that after failing at the task themselves, people were more likely to give helpful clues to strangers than friends. These data suggest that good performance on the part of a friend was more threatening than good performance on the part of a stranger. It's an ugly truth about people. But these results show that we undermine our friends when there is a risk they'll outperform us in important domains. This is what sexual selection has wrought. Part 2. Leveraging the past to understand the present. Chapter 5. Homo socialis. A few decades ago, I was teaching with Semester at Sea, a study abroad program that travels the world by ocean liner. One moonless night on the Indian Ocean, the captain switched off the exterior lights so we could more easily see the stars. I was curious to see the Milky Way without any light pollution, so I meandered up to the top deck before going to bed. The night sky was crammed with stars, and I had spent about 5 minutes admiring it when an extraordinarily bright meteor blazed into view and then burned out right before my eyes. It was one of the most amazing sights of my entire life, and I found myself surprised by my own response. Rather than savoring the moment or reflecting on my good fortune, I immediately looked around to see if anyone else was on deck with me. All I wanted was to turn to someone, anyone at all, and say, "Wow, did you see that?" And hear even a complete stranger respond, "Yes, that was amazing." As a child, I had always envied Tigger in Winnie the Pooh for being the only one. But this experience taught me that I misunderstood my own preferences. Rather than feeling more special because I was quite possibly the only human on Earth to witness this spectacle, I found that the meteor felt less real, and the experience of seeing it less meaningful because I couldn't share it. Of all the preferences that evolution gave us, I suspect the desire to share the contents of our minds played the single most important role in elevating us to the top of the food chain. The desire to share the contents of our minds is one of two key traits that Thomas Sudendorf identifies as uniquely human in The Gap. More on this in Chapter 6. We are the fiercest predator on the planet by virtue of the power of our minds. But even human minds aren't that special on their own. If you drop one of us naked and alone into the wilderness, you've just fed the creatures of the local forest. But if you drop 100 of us naked into the wilderness, you've introduced a new top predator to this unfortunate stretch of woods. In chapters 1 and 2, I discuss the central role of social functioning in our evolutionary success story. Nothing is more important to us than our social connections, because nothing was more critical for our ancestors' survival and reproduction. As a result, we've evolved many ways to stay connected to our groups. Chief among them is to know what others are thinking. Knowing others' thoughts helps us fit in and predict what our group members will do next. We also want our group to know our thoughts and feelings, as planting our beliefs in the minds of others provides the best opportunity for nudging the group in our preferred direction. Acceptance of our thoughts and feelings by others also validates our place in the group and gives us a sense of security about our future. As luck would have it, these two inherently self-serving goals are also a recipe for successful cooperation. When we know the contents of one another's minds, we are much more capable of social coordination and division of labor. For these reasons, evolution has given us a perpetual desire to share the contents of our minds, even when there is nothing to gain at the moment by doing so. This desire to share our experiences, which I felt so acutely on the deck of the ship that night, emerges early in life. Toddlers endlessly narrate the world, pointing out people and objects simply to establish joint attention. No other animal does this at any stage of development. The desire to share our understanding and experience goes beyond mere knowledge, as we also want to share our emotional reactions with others. For our group to deal effectively with a threat or opportunity, we must all perceive it the same way, and thus we have evolved to seek emotional consensus. There are few experiences in life more frustrating than sharing an emotional story with someone who reacts with indifference or an emotion opposite to our own. If I'm outraged by my colleague's rude behavior, I'm even more outraged when my wife thinks it's no big deal, or worse yet, funny or justified. This need to share emotional experience sits at the root of nearly all exaggeration. If I'm worried that you won't be sufficiently impressed by the fish I caught, then the fish grows in the telling. If I'm worried that you won't be upset by my colleague's rude behavior, then my colleague gets ruder when I relay the story. This need also sits at the heart of urban legends, which are the viral equivalent of gross exaggerations. Chip Heath of Stanford University and his colleagues provide a nice example of this effect in their research on urban legends. They found that the more disgusting and outrageous the legends become, the more likely people are to say they would pass them on to others. For example, they presented people with different versions of an urban legend in which a family returns from vacation to find photos in their camera that the bellboy took of himself fouling their toothbrushes. In one version, the photos show him cleaning his nails with their toothbrushes. In another, he has their toothbrushes stuck in his armpits. And in the coup de grace, they see the bellboy with the family toothbrushes up his booty. It doesn't take much thought to decide which story you'd tell your friends. The family toothbrushes in the bellboy's booty are a clear winner if your goal is to ensure your audience shares your emotional reaction. When we exaggerate or pass on urban legends, we introduce distortion into our listeners' understanding of reality. This can be seen as a costly side effect of the need to share emotions, but it shouldn't detract from the fact that sharing emotions lies at the root of almost all successful social interaction. Think back to the last conversation you had with a friend and ask yourself, how much new information was transmitted versus how much emotion was transmitted? Meaningful conversations are often very light on information, but they are almost never light on emotion. And conversations that are heavy on content, such as discussions of current events, are typically laden with emotion as well. The rare conversations that involve no emotion at all are typically with strangers and are perceived as trivial or boring. Social intelligence. The most important challenge people face in life is understanding and managing others. If I understand other people's goals, I can position myself to benefit from their likely actions. Better yet, if I can manage other people's agendas such that I plant my goals in their minds, I will almost assuredly be a success in life. On the other hand, if I can't understand others, I'll be buffeted around by their seemingly random plans. And if I can understand others but not manage them, I'll see the bad news coming, but will have limited capacity to improve my situation. Management skills are less important if I'm Genghis Khan and can push my agenda on others by brute force, but for most of us, persuasion is the key to success. What does the science tell us about how to be a social success? Unfortunately, not much. The answer has proven to be incredibly elusive due to the challenges of measuring social intelligence, which have remained largely unchanged since the first comprehensive test was created in the mid-1920s. Consider an item on that original test that asked people what they would say to an acquaintance whose relative had just died. Participants were presented with the choice of speaking well of the departed relative or talking about current events of general interest. A moment's reflection makes it clear that either or neither of these choices might prove to be correct. For what it's worth, the authors of the original test declared that talking about current events is the correct answer. So I Googled, "What are you supposed to say at a funeral?" And three of the first four answers involved speaking well of the departed relative. The fourth was about putting the family in your prayers. Perhaps norms have changed over the last 90 years, but I suspect there never was and never will be a universally correct way to handle most social situations. Indeed, the correct response to this question depends on how well you know the acquaintance and the deceased, their relationship, and countless other factors. As a consequence, one person's gaffe could easily be another person's comforting or uplifting words. Although it's generally inadvisable to make jokes about the deceased at the funeral of a beloved relative, I suspect that many people have in fact comforted their friends and family with such jokes. and I'm equally confident that many other people have offended their friends and family with the exact same jokes. The same statement can be either comforting or upsetting depending on who makes it, who is listening, exactly when it is made, the tone of voice with which it is made, and so on. The more you think about this problem, the more you realize that there is rarely a single correct social behavior in any given situation. The context-dependent nature of emotional responses, and hence social appropriateness, continues to stymie our efforts to measure social abilities. For example, an item from one of the most widely used current measures of social-emotional intelligence describes a person who works harder than his colleagues, gets better results, but is not good at office politics, and loses out on a merit award to an undeserving colleague. Test takers are asked how much it would help the person who lost out on the award to feel better if he made a list of the positive and negative features of his undeserving colleague versus told others what a poor job his undeserving colleague had done and gathered evidence to prove his point. In truth, the answer to such a question is unknowable. Some people would benefit from one strategy, some from another, and the benefits they'd gain would assuredly depend on a wide variety of other factors and constraints. The latter strategy could clearly be a disaster, but it may conceivably be a winner as well. The developers of the test provide correct answers by assessing the consensus of what most people would do and by surveying experts in emotion research. Both these approaches are deeply inadequate, however, as they rely on the flawed assumption that there is a single correct answer waiting to be found. Even if such an answer existed, this approach also assumes that what most people would do is the best strategy, thereby limiting the upper end of social intelligence to the average response, or perhaps even worse, the intuitions and inclinations of academic psychologists. I suspect that highly socially skilled individuals achieve their goals in part by doing things differently. When most people respond in a certain way, that response loses some of its power through repetition and predictability. Socially skilled people recognize this problem, and by finding a way to be just a little different from everyone else, they communicate more effectively. These challenges struck me as insurmountable, so they led me to take a different approach to the problem. Rather than trying to find a way around the context-dependent nature of social intelligence, my colleagues and I decided to harness this defining feature of social functioning. There are clearly many qualities that enable people to be socially successful, but the fact that what works in one situation often does not work in another suggests that behavioral flexibility may be the single most important attribute for skilled social functioning. A number of factors enable behavioral flexibility. More on this later. But one of the most important is our capacity for self-control. The evolution of self-control. A running joke among academic psychologists is that we entered this field to try to understand our own failings. That is, we conduct me-search rather than research. I'm as guilty of this charge as the professor in the office next to me. My interest in social intelligence began not with a burning intellectual question, but with an embarrassing faux pas when I was in high school and blurted out the first thought that passed through my head. Speaking before thinking gets me into trouble in a variety of circumstances, but food markets are my Achilles heel, particularly when meat looks like it did on the hoof. In combination with a fair bit of squeamishness, my carnivore's guilt over the fact that my dinner once roamed this planet leads me to prefer foods that don't resemble the animal from which they came. I get the willies when tapas bars hang pig legs from the rafters, when Chinese restaurants hang ducks in rows on hooks, or when a butcher's shop displays an entire carcass. I don't even like fish looking back at me. More than once, I've made a disgusted expression in front of a shopkeeper before my, admittedly weak, internal filter had a chance to stop me. My friends and family are unimpressed with my behavior, so I set out to prove that it's not my fault, that I'm the victim of faulty brain structures and should be pitied rather than censured. One way to envision self-control is to imagine that your brain is like a chariot. The horses are your impulses, and they reside primarily in a small set of regions that sit under your cortex, near the base of your brain, such as the nucleus accumbens and the amygdala. The horses pull you toward gratification of your desires. Food, sex, aggression, whatever it may be. Some people have wild stallions pulling their chariot, and they struggle to resist the temptation to eat too much, drink too much, have affairs, or punch the annoying guy in the nose. Other people are pulled along by petting farm ponies, and for them, managing their impulses is comparatively easy. The chariot driver, who sits in a piece of the frontal lobes called the lateral prefrontal cortex, LPFC, is the one who resists temptation by reining in or redirecting the horses when the time, location, or goal itself is inappropriate. The driver has a co-pilot, who sits above the horses in or about the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, and whose job is to alert the driver whenever the horses appear to be heading in the wrong direction. If you have an inattentive co-pilot or a weak driver, the horses will pull you pretty much wherever they like, and people will tell you that you're a wild one or an impulsive jerk, depending on whether they sympathize with your actions. In my own case, I think my ACC co-pilot is on permanent vacation. Perhaps my ACC is too small or is chronically starved of oxygen, or maybe it's just too quiet to be easily heard by my driver. Once my LPFC is pulling the reins, I've got perfectly good self-control, but I often don't notice that I need to control myself until it's too late. I blame my ACC, but of course others blame me. So my first experiment on social intelligence was an exculpatory effort designed to test my hypothesis that blurting out what you're really thinking is a sign of faulty frontal lobes rather than a moral failing. In this experiment, we decided to reenact my frequent faux pas with unusual foods, which meant that we had to come up with an excuse to present people in the lab with a food item that looked as it did when it originally walked this planet. And we're back to the me-search component of my work. After putting our heads together, my doctoral student, Karen Gonsalcorale, and I decided to use her Chinese ethnicity and cooking skills to our advantage. We brought Caucasian participants into the lab, and Karen explained, that is, she lied, that she was testing the effects of different food chemicals on memory. After looking up the participant's name and pretending to consult her clipboard, Karen then told each person, "You're in luck. You get to eat my favorite food, which is widely regarded as the national dish of China." Our deception regarding food chemicals and memory allowed us to serve the participants an unusual food in the lab that would otherwise have seemed odd. Karen's claims about the personal and cultural significance of the dish were intended to communicate one simple message: whatever you're served next, you should at least pretend to like it. On hidden camera and in close proximity to the participants' faces, she then opened a Tupperware bowl containing intact chicken feet, claws and all, cooked in a light brown sauce. Not everyone responded politely when given the feet to eat. My favorite participant blurted out, "That is bloody revolting!" This statement was followed by an awkward silence, which he broke with a few apologetic mumbles as he sheepishly picked up a foot and tried to muster the courage to nibble on one of the toes. In contrast, some people never lost their composure. They didn't necessarily eat the feet. Many suddenly remembered they were vegetarian or suggested that the feet might not be kosher, but they were polite even if they declined to eat them. In the next phase of the experiment, we used the Stroop test to see if we could differentiate those who had handled this delicate situation politely from those who had not. The Stroop test takes advantage of the fact that reading is automatic, and thus we cannot help but read a word once we see it. For example, if you were to try to look at the word hello without reading it, I'd hazard a guess that you'd fail. If you saw it, you would read it. In the Stroop test, people are asked to name, as quickly as they can, the colors of the letters that make up various words. The tricky bit is that the words themselves are names of colors. For example, people might see the word red written in green letters, which requires them to inhibit their automatic tendency to report the word they read and instead report the color of the letters. When people take the Stroop test in an fMRI magnet, an instrument that allows researchers to monitor metabolic activity in different brain regions, we see that the ACC copilot becomes active whenever the color word doesn't match the color of the letters and there is competition in people's minds between the correct and incorrect response. This ACC activation is even stronger when people make a mistake. At that point, the ACC alerts the chariot driver, who reins in the tendency to read the word rather than name the ink color. Because the Stroop test taps processing in the ACC, we expected that it would predict how people reacted to the chicken feet. People who have a responsive ACC should be good at inhibiting their initial reaction, yuck, and replacing it with something more socially appropriate, interesting. Consistent with our expectations, those who did well on the Stroop test were less likely to lose their composure than those who did poorly on the Stroop test. These findings showed us that people who had better self-control were able to respond in a more flexible and socially skilled manner. They were able to inhibit responses that they would typically have made but were inappropriate under the current set of social rules. Subsequent work has shown that the blurting we found in the lab is only the tip of the iceberg. 2 years later, Christopher Patrick of the University of Minnesota and his colleagues showed that a quiet ACC not only is problematic when it comes to saying the wrong thing, it also stands idly by when people do the wrong thing. In their study, they selected people who either reported having engaged in previous antisocial behavior or not, and gave them a task very similar to the Stroop test while they wore a swim cap covered with electrodes. Because neurons emit tiny amounts of electricity, these electrodes enabled the researchers to see how their participants' ACC responded when they made a mistake and pushed the wrong computer key. Despite the rather bland nature of this laboratory task, Patrick and his colleagues could tell whether someone had engaged in antisocial behavior by how their ACC responded when they made a trivial mistake. When they made an error on this task, the more law-abiding folks showed an ACC response that was about 30% larger than that of the antisocial folks. Remember, the ACC copilot's job is to notice the potential for conflict and alert the driver when an error is coming. A poor copilot responds weakly to the possibility of error, much as we see in this experiment. Presumably, when the antisocial people were about to make a more important decision, such as whether to punch the guy who's annoying them or throw a rock through someone's window, their ACC was similarly quiet and failed to alert them to the conflict between what they were about to do and what they should be doing. These data reveal how an unresponsive ACC copilot can lead to poor social functioning. I was delighted that these experiments vindicated me, showing that my failings revealed faulty brain structures rather than a faulty character. In retrospect, though, it's clear that my self-serving agenda blinded me to the more important message this research was telling us. These studies show that self-control plays an important role in social functioning. But it didn't occur to me, for quite some time, that social demands are probably what led to the evolution of self-control in the first place. You don't need an ACC copilot to tell you not to grab a salmon from a bear's mouth. That would be obvious even to the most distracted of chariot drivers. Rather, you need your ACC to ring the alarm when you're reaching for the last piece of cake, flirting with the big guy's girlfriend, or starting to tell your boss what you really think of him. Social interactions are loaded with conflicting motives, which is precisely when we need the services of an attentive copilot. My goals are sometimes consistent with yours, for example, when we want to see the same movie, and sometimes at cross purposes, for example, when we want to see the same girl. And that's when an attentive copilot plays a particularly valuable role. It was not just my egocentrism that blinded me to what these studies showed. Most psychologists have taken it for granted that we evolved the capacity for self-control in order to pursue long-term goals. To be a successful farmer, we must plant the seed rather than eat it. To have a happy retirement, we must save our money rather than spend it. To maintain a healthy body weight, we must decline the second piece of chocolate cake rather than eat it. But our world looks nothing like the world of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, who didn't plant seeds or save money, and who never worried about eating or drinking too much. Our ancestors were focused on today, with occasional thoughts of what they'd like to do tomorrow, so their lives were not the perpetual exercise in delayed gratification that ours have become. They almost assuredly did not rely on self-control to secure a better tomorrow. But they did have to control themselves to get along with their neighbors, manage their rivals, and achieve their social goals. Our ancestors also had to control themselves whenever they engaged in cooperative efforts, particularly in the face of threat. Imagine what it was like for our distant ancestors who had migrated to the savannah and were a toothsome snack for hyenas or lions. When they noticed one of those beasts stalking them, it would have taken a monumental act of self-control to band together and throw stones at it rather than run away. A cooperative strategy was clearly the most effective way to achieve the survival goal that everyone shared, but fear would have made it awfully tempting to leave the task of protecting the group to others. Those who were unwilling to share the burden and who ran away at the first sign of danger would soon have found themselves unwelcome in the group, facing dire circumstances and poor reproductive prospects. Evolution thus favored the development of self-control in our ancestors to achieve a variety of social goals. The joint actions of the ACC and LPFC enable self-control, but there's more to self-control than restraining ourselves in the face of temptation. Our big brains allow us to reframe the physical world in abstract terms, helping us to see it in terms of problems to be solved rather than potentially overwhelming temptations. To explain what I mean, let's consider a wonderful experiment with chimpanzees conducted by Sarah Boyson and Gary Berntsen at Ohio State University. First, Boyson taught the chimps the numerals for 1 through 9. She then taught them to play a game that involved choosing the number of treats they would like to receive. In the game, two chimps are seated across from each other, and one chimp, we'll call this one the chooser, has the opportunity to decide how many treats each will receive. The chooser is shown numbers on two separate cards, and its task is to point to one of the two numbers. The trick to this game is that the other chimp receives the number of treats shown on the card the chooser chimp points to, and the chooser receives the number of treats indicated on the other card. Chimps are not good at sharing, so their goal is always to get the larger pile for themselves and have the smaller pile go to the other chimp. As a consequence, they soon learned to point to the smaller number in order to score the larger pile of treats. The key to the study was what happened when Boyson presented the chimps with actual piles of treats rather than cards with numbers. Actual treats should have made the task easier, and the chimps more successful at getting the larger pile because the chimps don't need to remember what the numbers represent to win the game. Yet, the exact opposite occurred. Despite knowing the rules of the game, the chimps repeatedly pointed to the larger pile of tasty treats in front of them. The chimps appeared to realize their mistake immediately, often seeming very frustrated with themselves. Remarkably, they went on to make the same mistake on the very next round, and the next for literally hundreds of rounds. Why did these clever animals repeatedly make this simple error? Most likely, they could not escape the lure of the actual treats. When Boyson helped them translate treats into an abstract problem by showing them numerals, the chimps were able to take a mental step back and consider the problem objectively. But their limited symbolic abilities weren't strong enough to transform the physical treats in front of them into an abstraction, and as a result, the temptation was too great. The treats were just too enticing for the chimps' frontal lobes to put the brakes on and stop them from pointing to the larger pile. Because chimp frontal lobes are smaller than our own, their control functions and ability to think in abstract terms are not as strong as ours. Humans can easily convert piles of candies into an abstract problem, allowing us to think of the treats as numbers rather than objects. Once we translate our problems into abstractions, our temptations don't swamp our control functions. In contrast, the chimps could achieve this conversion only when